When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 5 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Enchanted Types. One time, a Nook became tired of his beautiful life and longed for something new to do. The Nooks have more wonderful powers than any other immortal folk, except perhaps the fairies and Ryls. So one would suppose that a Nook who might gain anything he desired by a simple wish could not be otherwise than happy and contented. But such was not the case with Popopo, the Nook we are speaking of. He had lived thousands of years, and had enjoyed all the wonders he could think of. Yet life had become as tedious to him now as it might be to one who was unable to gratify a single wish. Finally, by chance, Popopo thought of the earth people who dwell in cities, and so he resolved to visit them and see how they lived. This would surely be fine amusement, and serve to pass away many wearisome hours. Therefore, one morning, after a breakfast so dainty that you could scarcely imagine it, Popopo set out for the earth, and at once was in the midst of a big city. His own dwelling was so quiet and peaceful that the roaring noise of the town startled him. His nerves were so shocked that, before he had looked around 3 minutes, he decided to give up the adventure and instantly return home. This satisfied for a time his desire to visit the earth cities, but soon the monotony of his existence again made him restless and gave him another thought. At night the people slept, and the cities would be quiet. He would visit them at night. So, at the proper time, Popopo transported himself in a jiffy to a great city, where he began wandering about the streets. Everyone was in bed. No wagons rattled along the pavements. No throngs of busy men shouted and halloed. Even the policemen slumbered slyly, and there happened to be no prowling thieves abroad. His nerves being soothed by the stillness, Popopo began to enjoy himself. He entered many of the houses and examined their rooms with much curiosity. Locks and bolts made no difference to a Nook, and he saw as well in darkness as in daylight. After a time he strolled into the business portion of the city. Stores are unknown among the immortals who have no need of money or of barter and exchange, so Popopo was greatly interested by the novel sight of so many collections of goods and merchandise. During his wanderings he entered a millinery shop, and was surprised to see within a large glass case a great number of women's hats, each bearing in one position or another a stuffed bird. Indeed, some of the most elaborate hats had two or three birds upon them. Now Nooks are the especial guardians of birds and love them dearly. To see so many of his little friends shut up in a glass case annoyed and grieved Popopo, who had no idea they had purposely been placed upon the hats by the milliner. So he slid back one of the doors of the case, gave the little chirruping whistle of the Nooks that all birds know well, and called, "Come, friends, the door is open. Fly out!" Popopo did not know the birds were stuffed, but, stuffed or not, every bird is bound to obey a Nook's whistle and a Nook's call. So they left the hats, flew out of the case, and began fluttering about the room. "Poor dears," said the kind-hearted Nook, "you long to be in the fields and forests again." Then he opened the outer door for them and cried, "Off with you! Fly away, my beauties, and be happy again!" The astonished birds at once obeyed, and when they had soared away into the night air, the Nook closed the door and continued his wandering through the streets. By dawn he saw many interesting sights, but day broke before he had finished the city, and he resolved to come the next evening, a few hours earlier. As soon as it was dark the following day, he came again to the city, and on passing the millinery shop, noticed a light within. Entering, he found two women, one of whom leaned her head upon the table and sobbed bitterly, while the other strove to comfort her. Of course, Popopo was invisible to mortal eyes, so he stood by and listened to their conversation.
"Cheer up, sister," said one. "Even though your pretty birds have all been stolen, the hats themselves remain."
"Alas," cried the other, who was the milliner, "no one will buy my hats partly trimmed, for the fashion is to wear birds upon them, and if I cannot sell my goods, I shall be utterly ruined."
Then she renewed her sobbing, and the Knook stole away, feeling a little ashamed to realize that in his love for the birds he had unconsciously wronged one of the Earth People, and made her unhappy. This thought brought him back to the millinery shop later in the night, when the two women had gone home. He wanted, in some way, to replace the birds upon the hats, that the poor woman might be happy again. So he searched until he came upon a nearby cellar full of little gray mice, who lived quite undisturbed and gained a livelihood by gnawing through the walls into neighboring houses and stealing food from the pantries. "Here are just the creatures," thought Popopo, "to place upon the woman's hats. Their fur is almost as soft as the plumage of the birds, and it strikes me the mice are remarkably pretty and graceful animals. Moreover, they now pass their lives in stealing, and were they obliged to remain always upon women's hats, their morals would be much improved." So he exercised a charm that drew all the mice from the cellar and placed them upon the hats in the glass case, where they occupied the places the birds had vacated and looked very becoming, at least in the eyes of the unworldly Knook. To prevent their running about and leaving the hats, Popopo rendered them motionless, and then he was so pleased with his work that he decided to remain in the shop and witness the delight of the milliner when she saw how daintily her hats were now trimmed. She came in the early morning accompanied by her sister, and her face wore a sad and resigned expression. After sweeping and dusting the shop, and drawing the blinds, she opened the case and took out a hat. But when she saw a tiny gray mouse nestling among the ribbons and laces, she gave a loud shriek and, dropping the hat, sprang with one bound to the top of the table. The sister, knowing the shriek to be one of fear, leapt upon a chair and exclaimed, "What is it? Oh, what is it?"
"A mouse!" gasped the milliner, trembling with terror.
Popopo, seeing this commotion, now realized that mice are especially disagreeable to human beings, and that he had made a grave mistake in placing them upon the hats, so he gave a low whistle of command that was heard only by the mice. Instantly, they all jumped from the hats, dashed out the open door of the glass case, and scampered away to their cellar. But this action so frightened the milliner and her sister that after giving several loud screams they fell upon their backs on the floor and fainted away. Popopo was a kind-hearted Knook, but on witnessing all this misery, caused by his own ignorance of the ways of humans, he straightway wished himself at home, and so left the poor women to recover as best they could. Yet he could not escape a sad feeling of responsibility, and after thinking upon the matter he decided that since he had caused the milliner's unhappiness by freeing the birds, he could set the matter right by restoring them to the glass case. He loved the birds, and disliked to condemn them to slavery again, but that seemed the only way to end the trouble. So he set off to find the birds. They had flown a long distance, but it was nothing to Popopo to reach them in a second, and he discovered them sitting upon the branches of a big chestnut tree and singing gaily. When they saw the Knook, the birds cried, "Thank you, Popopo! Thank you for setting us free!"
"Do not thank me," returned the Knook, "for I have come to send you back to the millinery shop."
"Why?" demanded a blue jay angrily, while the others stopped their songs.
"Because I find the woman considers you her property, and your loss has caused her much unhappiness," answered Popopo.
"But remember how unhappy we were in her glass case," said a robin redbreast gravely.
"And as for being her property, you are a Knook, and the natural guardian of all birds, so you know that nature created us free. To be sure, wicked men shot and stuffed us, and sold us to the milliner, but the idea of our being her property is nonsense."
Popopo was puzzled.
"If I leave you free," he said, "wicked men will shoot you again, and you will be no better off than before."
"Pooh!" exclaimed the blue jay. "We cannot be shot now, for we are stuffed. Indeed, two men fired several shots at us this morning, but the bullets only ruffled our feathers and buried themselves in our stuffing. We do not fear men now."
"Listen," said Popopo sternly, for he felt the birds were getting the best of the argument. "The poor milliner's business will be ruined if I do not return you to her shop. It seems you are necessary to trim the hats properly. It is the fashion for women to wear birds upon their headgear. So the poor milliner's wares, although beautified by lace and ribbons, are worthless unless you are perched upon them."
"Fashions," said a blackbird solemnly,
are made by men. What law is there among birds or nooks that requires us to be the slaves of fashion?"
"What have we to do with fashions, anyway?" screamed a linnet. "If it were the fashion to wear nooks perched upon women's hats, would you be contented to stay there? Answer me, Popopo."
But Popopo was in despair. He could not wrong the birds by sending them back to the milliner, nor did he wish the milliner to suffer by their loss. So he went home to think what could be done. After much meditation, he decided to consult the King of the Nooks, and going at once to His Majesty, he told him the whole story. The King frowned. "This should teach you the folly of interfering with Earth people," he said. "But since you have caused all this trouble, it is your duty to remedy it. Our birds cannot be enslaved, that is certain. Therefore, you must have the fashions changed, so it will no longer be stylish for women to wear birds upon their hats."
"How shall I do that?" asked Popopo.
"Easily enough. Fashions often change among the Earth people, who tire quickly of any one thing. When they read in their newspapers and magazines that the style is so-and-so, they never question the matter, but at once obey the mandate of fashion. So you must visit the newspapers and magazines, and enchant the types."
"Enchant the types?" echoed Popopo, in wonder.
"Just so. Make them read that it is no longer the fashion to wear birds upon hats. That will afford relief to your poor milliner, and at the same time set free thousands of our darling birds, who have been so cruelly used." Popopo thanked the wise king, and followed his advice. The office of every newspaper and magazine in the city was visited by the Nook, and then he went to other cities, until there was not a publication in the land that had not had a new fashion note in its pages. Sometimes Popopo enchanted the types, so that whoever read the print would see only what the Nook wished them to. Sometimes he called upon the busy editors and befuddled their brains until they wrote exactly what he wanted them to. Mortals seldom know how greatly they are influenced by fairies, nooks, and rills, who often put thoughts into their heads that only the wise little immortals could have conceived. The following morning, when the poor milliner looked over her newspaper, she was overjoyed to read that no woman could now wear a bird upon her hat and be in style, for the newest fashion required only ribbons and laces. Popopo, after this, found much enjoyment in visiting every millinery shop he could find, and giving new life to the stuffed birds, which were carelessly tossed aside as useless. And they flew to the fields and forests with songs of thanks to the good Nook who had rescued them. Sometimes a hunter fires his gun at a bird, and then wonders why he did not hit it. But, having read this story, you will understand that the bird must have been a stuffed one from some millinery shop, which cannot, of course, be killed by a gun. End of The Enchanted Types. Recording by Matthew Rees. Davenport, Iowa.
Section 6 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Rees. The Laughing Hippopotamus. On one of the upper branches of the Congo River lived an ancient and aristocratic family of hippopotamuses, which boasted a pedigree dating back beyond the days of Noah, beyond the existence of mankind, far into the dim ages when the world was new. They had always lived upon the banks of this same river, so that every curve and sweep of its waters, every pit and shallow of its bed, every rock and stump and wallow upon its bank, was as familiar to them as their own mothers. And they are living there yet, I suppose. Not long ago, the queen of this tribe of hippopotamuses had a child which she named Keo, because it was so fat and round. Still, that you may not be misled, I will say that in the hippopotamus language, Keo, properly translated, means fat and lazy, instead of fat and round. However, no one called the queen's attention to this error, because her tusks were monstrous long and sharp, and she thought Keo the sweetest baby in the world. He was, indeed, all right for a hippopotamus. He rolled and played in the soft mud of the river bank, and waddled inland to nibble the leaves of the wild cabbage that grew there, and was happy and contented from morning till night. And he was the jolliest hippopotamus that ancient family had ever known. His little red eyes were forever twinkling with fun, and he laughed his merry laugh on all occasions, whether there was anything to laugh at or not. Therefore, the black people who dwelt in that region called him Ippy, the Jolly One, although they dared not come anigh him, on account of his fierce mother, and his equally fierce uncles and aunts and cousins, who lived in a vast colony upon the river bank.
and while these black people, who lived in the little villages scattered among the trees, dared not openly attack the royal family of hippopotamuses, they were amazingly fond of eating hippopotamus meat whenever they could get it. This was no secret to the hippopotamuses. And, again, when the blacks managed to catch these animals alive, they had a trick of riding them through the jungles as if they were horses, thus reducing them to a condition of slavery. Therefore, having these things in mind, whenever the tribe of hippopotamuses smelled the oily odor of black people, they were accustomed to charge upon them furiously, and if by chance they overtook one of the enemy, they would rip him with their sharp tusks or stamp him into the earth with their huge feet. It was continual warfare between the hippopotamuses and the black people. Gooey lived in one of the little villages of the blacks. He was the son of the chief's brother and grandson of the village sorcerer, the latter being an aged man known as the Boneless Wonder, because he could twist himself into as many coils as a serpent, and had no bones to hinder his bending his flesh into any position. This made him walk in a wobbly fashion, but the black people had great respect for him. Gooey's hut was made of branches of trees stuck together with mud, and his clothing consisted of a grass mat tied around his middle. But his relationship to the chief and the sorcerer gave him a certain dignity, and he was much addicted to solitary thought. Perhaps it was natural that these thoughts frequently turned upon his enemies, the hippopotamuses, and that he should consider many ways of capturing them. Finally, he completed his plans and set about digging a great pit in the ground, midway between two sharp curves of the river. When the pit was finished, he covered it over with small branches of trees, and strewed earth upon them, smoothing the surface so artfully that no one would suspect there was a big hole underneath. Then Gooey laughed softly to himself, and went home to supper. That evening the queen said to Keo, who was growing to be a fine child for his age, "I wish you'd run across the bend and ask your Uncle Nicky to come here. I have found a strange plant, and I want him to tell me if it is good to eat." The Jolly One laughed heartily as he started upon his errand, for he felt as important as a boy does when he is sent for the first time to the corner grocery to buy a yeast cake. "Guck-a-cuck-cuck, guck-a-cuck-cuck," was the way he laughed, and if you think a hippopotamus does not laugh this way, you have but to listen to one, and you will find I am right. He crawled out of the mud where he was wallowing, and tramped away through the bushes, and the last his mother heard as she lay half in and half out of the water was his musical guck-a-cuck-cuck dying away in the distance. Keo was in such a happy mood that he scarcely noticed where he stepped, so he was much surprised when, in the middle of a laugh, the ground gave way beneath him, and he fell to the bottom of Gooey's deep pit. He was not badly hurt, but had bumped his nose severely as he went down, so he stopped laughing and began to think how he should get out again. Then he found the walls were higher than his head, and that he was a prisoner. So he laughed a little at his own misfortune, and the laughter soothed him to sleep, so that he snored all through the night until daylight came. When Gooey peered over the edge of the pit next morning, he exclaimed, "Why, 'tis Ippy, the Jolly One!" Keo recognized the scent of a black man and tried to raise his head high enough to bite him, seeing which Gooey spoke in the hippopotamus language, which he had learned from his grandfather, the sorcerer. "Have peace, little one. You are my captive." "Yes, I will have a piece of your leg if I can reach it," retorted Keo, and then he laughed at his own joke. "Guck-a-cuck-cuck." But Gooey, being a thoughtful black man, went away without further talk, and did not return until the following morning. When he again leaned over the pit, Keo was so weak from hunger that he could hardly laugh at all. "Do you give up?" asked Gooey, "or do you still wish to fight?" "What will happen if I give up?" inquired Keo. The black man scratched his woolly head in perplexity. "It is hard to say, Ippy. You are too young to work, and if I kill you for food I shall lose your tusks, which are not yet grown. Why, O Jolly One, did you fall into my hole? I wanted to catch your mother or one of your uncles." "Guck-a-cuck-cuck," laughed Keo. "You must let me go after all, black man, for I am of no use to you." "That I will not do," declared Gooey. "Unless," he added as an afterthought, "you will make a bargain with me." "Let me hear about the bargain, black one, for I am hungry," said Keo. "I will let you go if you swear by the tusks of your grandfather that you will return to me in a year and a day and become my prisoner again." The youthful hippopotamus paused to think, for he knew it was a solemn thing to swear by the tusks of his grandfather. But he was exceedingly hungry, and a year and a day seemed a long time off,
So he said, with another careless laugh, "Very well. If you will now let me go, I swear, by the tusks of my grandfather, to return to you in a year and a day, and become your prisoner." Gooey was much pleased, for he knew that in a year and a day Keo would be almost full grown. So he began digging away one end of the pit, and filling it up with the earth, until he had made an incline which would allow the hippopotamus to climb out. Keo was so pleased when he found himself upon the surface of the earth again that he indulged in a merry fit of laughter, after which he said, "Good-bye, Gooey. In a year and a day you will see me again." Then he waddled away toward the river to see his mother and get his breakfast, and Gooey returned to his village. During the months that followed, as the black man lay in his hut or hunted in the forest, he heard at times the faraway guk-guk-guk of the laughing hippopotamus. But he only smiled to himself and thought, "A year and a day will soon pass away." Now when Keo returned to his mother safe and well, every member of his tribe was filled with joy, for the Jolly One was a general favorite. But when he told them that in a year and a day he must again become the slave of the black man, they began to wail and weep, and so many were their tears that the river rose several inches. Of course Keo only laughed at their sorrow, but a great meeting of the tribe was called, and the matter discussed seriously. "Having sworn by the tusks of his grandfather," said Uncle Nicky, "he must keep his promise. But it is our duty to try in some way to rescue him from death or a life of slavery." To this all agreed, but no one could think of any method of saving Keo from his fate. So months passed away, during which all the royal hippopotamuses were sad and gloomy, except the Jolly One himself. Finally, but a week of freedom remained to Keo, and his mother, the queen, became so nervous and worried that another meeting of the tribe was called. By this time the laughing hippopotamus had grown to enormous size, and measured nearly 15 feet long and 6 feet high, while his sharp tusks were whiter and harder than those of an elephant. "Unless something is done to save my child," said the mother, "I shall die of grief." Then some of her relations began to make foolish suggestions, but presently Uncle Nep, a wise and very big hippopotamus, said, "We must go to Glinkomok and implore his aid." Then all were silent, for it was a bold thing to face the mighty Glinkomok. But the mother's love was equal to any heroism. "I will myself go to him, if Uncle Nep will accompany me," she said quickly. Uncle Nep thoughtfully patted the soft mud with his forefoot, and wagged his short tail leisurely from side to side. "We have always been obedient to Glinkomok, and shown him great respect," said he. "Therefore I fear no danger in facing him. I will go with you." All the others snorted approval, being very glad they were not called upon to go themselves. So the queen and Uncle Nep, with Keo swimming between them, set out upon their journey. They swam up the river all that day and all the next, until they came at sundown to a high rocky wall, beneath which was the cave where the mighty Glinkomok dwelt. This fearful creature was part beast, part man, part fowl, and part fish. It had lived since the world began. Through years of wisdom it had become part sorcerer, part wizard, part magician, and part fairy. Mankind knew it not, but the ancient beasts knew and feared it. The three hippopotamuses paused before the cave with their front feet upon the bank and their bodies in the water, and called in chorus a greeting to Glinkomok. Instantly thereafter the mouth of the cave darkened, and the creature glided silently toward them. The hippopotamuses were afraid to look upon it, and bowed their heads between their legs. "We come, O Glinkomok, to implore your mercy and friendly assistance," began Uncle Nep, and then he told the story of Keo's capture, and how he had promised to return to the black man.
"He must keep his promise," said the creature, in a voice that sounded like a sigh.
The mother hippopotamus groaned aloud.
"But I will prepare him to overcome the black man, and to regain his liberty," continued Glinkomok.
Keo laughed.
"Lift your right paw," commanded Glinkomok.
Keo obeyed, and the creature touched it with its long, hairy tongue. Then it held four skinny hands over Keo's bowed head, and mumbled some words in a language unknown to man or beast or fowl or fish. After this it spoke again in hippopotamese.
"Your skin has now become so tough that no man can hurt you. Your strength is greater than that of 10 elephants. Your foot is so swift that you can distance the wind. your wit is sharper than the bullthorn. Let the man fear, but drive fear from your own breast forever, for of all your race you are the mightiest." Then the terrible Glinkomok leaned over, and Keo felt its fiery breath scorch him as it whispered some further instructions in his ear. The next moment it glided back into its cave, followed by the loud thanks of the three hippopotamuses, who slid into the water and immediately began their journey home. The mother's heart was full of joy. Uncle Nep shivered once or twice, as he remembered a glimpse he had caught of Glinkomok. But Keo was as jolly as possible, and, not content to swim with his dignified elders, he dived under their bodies, raced all around them, and laughed merrily every inch of the way home. Then all the tribe held high jinks, and praised the mighty Glinkomok for befriending their queen's son. And when the day came for the Jolly One to give himself up to the black man, they all kissed him good-bye without a single fear for his safety. Keo went away in good spirits, and they could hear his laughing guk-guk-guk long after he was lost in sight in the jungle. Gooey had counted the days and knew when to expect Keo, but he was astonished at the monstrous size to which his captive had grown, and congratulated himself on the wise bargain he had made. And Keo was so fat that Gooey determined to eat him, that is, all of him he possibly could, and the remainder of the carcass he would trade off to his fellow villagers. So he took a knife and tried to stick it into the hippopotamus, but the skin was so tough the knife was blunted against it. Then he tried other means, but Keo remained unhurt. And now, indeed, the Jolly One laughed his most gleeful laugh, till all the forest echoed the guk-guk-guk-guk. And Gooey decided not to kill him, since that was impossible, but to use him for a beast of burden. He mounted upon Keo's back and commanded him to march. So Keo trotted briskly through the village, his little eyes twinkling with merriment. The other blacks were delighted with Gooey's captive, and begged permission to ride upon the Jolly One's back. So Gooey bargained with them for bracelets and shell necklaces and little gold ornaments until he had acquired quite a heap of trinkets. Then a dozen black men climbed upon Keo's back to enjoy a ride, and the one nearest his nose cried out, "Run, mud dog, run!" And Keo ran. Swift as the wind he strode, away from the village, through the forest and straight up the river bank. The black men howled with fear, the Jolly One roared with laughter, and on they rushed. Then before them, on the opposite side of the river, appeared the black mouth of Glinkomok's cave. Keo dashed into the water, dived to the bottom, and left the black people struggling to swim out. But Glinkomok had heard the laughter of Keo, and knew what to do. When the Jolly One rose to the surface and blew the water from his throat, there was no black man to be seen. Keo returned alone to the village, and Gooey asked with surprise, "Where are my brothers?" "I do not know," answered Keo. "I took them far away, and they remained where I left them." Gooey would have asked more questions then, but another crowd of black men impatiently waited to ride on the back of the laughing hippopotamus. So they paid the price and climbed to their seats, after which the foremost said, "Run, mud wallower, run!" And Keo ran as before, and carried them to the mouth of Glinkomok's cave, and returned alone. But now Gooey became anxious to know the fate of his fellows, for he was the only black man left in his village. So he mounted the hippopotamus and cried, "Run, river hog, run!" Keo laughed his jolly guk-guk-guk, and ran with the speed of the wind. But this time he made straight for the river bank where his own tribe lived, and when he reached it he waded into the river, dived to the bottom, and left Gooey floating in the middle of the stream. The black man began swimming toward the right bank, but there he saw Uncle Nep and half the royal tribe waiting to stamp him into the soft mud. So he turned to the left bank, and there stood the Queen Mother and Uncle Nicky, red-eyed and angry, waiting to tear him with their tusks. Then Gooey uttered loud screams of terror, and spying the Jolly One, who swam near him, he cried, "Save me, Keo, save me, and I will release you from slavery." "That is not enough," laughed Keo. "I will serve you all my life," screamed Gooey. "I will do everything you bid me." "Will you return to me in a year and a day, and become my captive, if I allow you to escape?" asked Keo. "I will! I will! I will!" cried Gooey. "Swear it by the bones of your grandfather," commanded Keo, remembering that black men have no tusks to swear by. And Gooey swore it by the bones of his grandfather. Then Keo swam to the black one, who clambered upon his back again. In this fashion they came to the bank, where Keo told his mother and all the tribe of the bargain he had made with Gooey, who was to return in a year and a day and become his slave.
Therefore, the black man was permitted to depart in peace, and once more the Jolly One lived with his own people and was happy. When a year and a day had passed, Keo began watching for the return of Gooey, but he did not come, then, or ever afterwards. For the black man had made a bundle of his bracelets and shell necklaces and little gold ornaments, and had travelled many miles into another country, where the ancient and royal tribe of hippopotamuses was unknown. And he set up for a great chief because of his riches, and people bowed down before him. By day he was proud and swaggering, but at night he tumbled and tossed upon his bed and could not sleep. His conscience troubled him, for he had sworn by the bones of his grandfather, and his grandfather had no bones. End of The Laughing Hippopotamus. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa. Section 7 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Magic Bonbons. There lived in Boston a wise and ancient chemist by the name of Dr. Dawes, who dabbled somewhat in magic. There also lived in Boston a young lady by the name of Clarabel Suds, who was possessed of much money, little wit, and an intense desire to go upon the stage. So Clarabel went to Dr. Dawes and said, "I can neither sing nor dance. I cannot recite verse nor play upon the piano. I am no acrobat nor leaper nor high kicker. Yet I wish to go upon the stage. What shall I do?" "Are you willing to pay for such accomplishments?" asked the wise chemist. "Certainly," answered Clarabel, jingling her purse. "Then come to me tomorrow at 2 o'clock," said he. All that night he practiced what is known as chemical sorcery, so that when Clarabel Suds came next day at 2 o'clock, he showed her a small box filled with compounds that closely resembled French bonbons. "This is a progressive age," said the old man, "and I flatter myself your Uncle Dawes keeps right along with the procession. Now, one of your old-fashioned sorcerers would have made you some nasty bitter pills to swallow, but I have consulted your taste and convenience. Here are some magic bonbons. If you eat this one with the lavender color, you can dance thereafter as lightly and gracefully as if you had been trained a lifetime. After you consume the pink confection, you will sing like a nightingale. Eating the white one will enable you to become the finest elocutionist in the land. The chocolate piece will charm you into playing the piano better than Rubinstein, while after eating the lemon-yellow bonbon you can easily kick 6 feet above your head." "How delightful!" exclaimed Clarabel, who was truly enraptured. "You are certainly a most clever sorcerer, as well as a considerate compounder." And she held out her hand for the box. "Ahem," said the wise one. "A check, please." "Oh, yes, to be sure. How stupid of me to forget it," she returned. He considerately retained the box in his own hand while she signed a check for a large amount of money, after which he allowed her to hold the box herself. "Are you sure you have made them strong enough?" she inquired anxiously. "It usually takes a great deal to affect me." "My only fear," replied Dr. Dawes, "is that I have made them too strong, for this is the first time I have ever been called upon to prepare these wonderful confections."
"Don't worry," said Clarabel. "The stronger they act, the better I shall act myself."
She went away after saying this, but stopping in at a dry-goods store to shop, she forgot the precious box in her new interest, and left it lying on the ribbon counter. Then little Bessie Bostwick came to the counter to buy a hair ribbon, and laid her parcels beside the box. When she went away, she gathered up the box with her other bundles and trotted off home with it. Bessie never knew until after she had hung her coat in the hall closet and counted up her parcels that she had one too many. Then she opened it and exclaimed, "Why, it's a box of candy! Someone must have mislaid it. But it is too small a matter to worry about. There are only a few pieces." So she dumped the contents of the box into a bonbon dish that stood upon the hall table, and picking out the chocolate piece — she was fond of chocolates — ate it daintily while she examined her purchases. These were not many, for Bessie was only 12 years old and was not yet trusted by her parents to expend much money at the stores. But while she tried on the hair ribbon, she suddenly felt a great desire to play upon the piano, and the desire at last became so overpowering that she went into the parlor and opened the instrument. the little girl had, with infinite pains, contrived to learn two pieces, which she usually executed with a jerky movement of her right hand and a left hand that forgot to keep up, and so made dreadful discords. But under the influence of the chocolate bonbon, she sat down and ran her fingers lightly over the keys, producing such exquisite harmony that she was filled with amazement at her own performance. That was the prelude, however. The next moment she dashed into Beethoven's Seventh Sonata and played it magnificently. Her mother, hearing the unusual burst of melody, came downstairs to see what musical guest had arrived, but when she discovered it was her own little daughter who was playing so divinely, she had an attack of palpitation of the heart, to which she was subject, and sat down upon a sofa until it should pass away. Meanwhile, Bessie played one piece after another with untiring energy. She loved music and now found that all she need do was sit at the piano and listen, and watch her hands twinkle over the keyboard. Twilight deepened in the room, and Bessie's father came home and hung up his hat and overcoat, and placed his umbrella in the rack. Then he peeped into the parlor to see who was playing.
"Great Caesar!" he exclaimed.
But the mother came to him softly with her finger on her lips and whispered, "Don't interrupt her, John. Our child seems to be in a trance. Did you ever hear such superb music?"
"Why, she's an infant prodigy," gasped the astounded father. "Beats blind Tom all hollow. It's wonderful."
As they stood listening, the senator arrived, having been invited to dine with them that evening. And before he had taken off his coat, the Yale professor, a man of deep learning and scholarly attainments, joined the party. Bessie played on, and the four elders stood in a huddled but silent and amazed group, listening to the music and waiting for the sound of the dinner gong. Mr. Bostwick, who was hungry, picked up the bonbon dish that lay on the table beside him and ate the pink confection. The professor was watching him, so Mr. Bostwick courteously held the dish toward him. The professor ate the lemon-yellow piece, and the senator reached out his hand and took the lavender piece. He did not eat it, however, for, chancing to remember that it might spoil his dinner, he put it in his vest pocket. Mrs. Bostwick, still intently listening to her precocious daughter, without thinking what she did, took the remaining piece, which was the white one, and slowly devoured it. The dish was now empty, and Clarabel Sudd's precious bonbons had passed from her possession forever. Suddenly, Mr. Bostwick, who was a big man, began to sing in a shrill, tremolo soprano voice. It was not the same song Bessie was playing, and the discord was shocking that the professor smiled, the senator put his hands to his ears, and Mrs. Bostwick cried in a horrified voice, "William!" Her husband continued to sing as if endeavoring to emulate the famous Christine Nilsson, and paid no attention whatever to his wife or his guests. Fortunately, the dinner gong now sounded, and Mrs. Bostwick dragged Bessie from the piano and ushered her guests into the dining room. Mr. Bostwick followed, singing "The Last Rose of Summer," as if it had been an encore demanded by a thousand delighted hearers. The poor woman was in despair at witnessing her husband's undignified actions, and wondered what she might do to control him. The professor seemed more grave than usual, the senator's face wore an offended expression, and Bessie kept moving her fingers as if she still wanted to play the piano. Mrs. Bostwick managed to get them all seated, although her husband had broken into another aria, and then the maid brought in the soup. When she carried a plate to the professor, he cried in an excited voice, "Hold it higher! Higher, I say!" And springing up, he gave it a sudden kick that sent it nearly to the ceiling, from whence the dish descended to scatter soup over Bessie and the maid, and to smash in pieces upon the crown of the professor's bald head. At this atrocious act, the senator rose from his seat with an exclamation of horror and glanced at his hostess. For some time Mrs. Bostwick had been staring straight ahead with a dazed expression, but now, catching the senator's eye, she bowed gracefully and began reciting "The Charge of the Light Brigade" in forceful tones. The senator shuddered. Such disgraceful rioting he had never seen nor heard before in a decent private family. He felt that his reputation was at stake, and, being the only sane person apparently in the room, there was no one to whom he might appeal. The maid had run away to cry hysterically in the kitchen. Mr. Bostwick was singing "Oh, Promise Me." The professor was trying to kick the globes off the chandelier. Mrs. Bostwick had switched her recitation to "The Boy Stood on the Burning Deck," and Bessie had stolen into the parlor and was pounding out the overture from "The Flying Dutchman." The senator was not at all sure he would not go crazy himself presently, so he slipped away from the turmoil and, catching up his hat and coat in the hall, hurried from the house. That night he sat up late, writing a political speech he was to deliver the next afternoon at Faneuil Hall.
but his experiences at the Bostwicks had so unnerved him that he could scarcely collect his thoughts, and often he would pause and shake his head pityingly as he remembered the strange things he had seen in that usually respectable home. The next day he met Mr. Bostwick in the street, but passed him by with a stony glare of oblivion. He felt he really could not afford to know this gentleman in the future. Mr. Bostwick was naturally indignant at the direct snub, yet in his mind lingered a faint memory of some quite unusual occurrences at his dinner party the evening before, and he hardly knew whether he dared resent the senator's treatment or not. The political meeting was the feature of the day, for the senator's eloquence was well known in Boston. So the big hall was crowded with people, and in one of the front rows sat the Bostwick family, with the learned Yale professor beside them. They all looked tired and pale, as if they had passed a rather dissipated evening, and the senator was rendered so nervous by seeing them that he refused to look in their direction a second time. While the mayor was introducing him, the great man sat fidgeting in his chair, and, happening to put his thumb and finger into his vest pocket, he found the lavender-colored bonbon he had placed there the evening before. "This may clear my throat," thought the senator, and slipped the bonbon into his mouth. A few minutes afterwards he rose before the vast audience, which greeted him with enthusiastic plaudits. "My friends," began the senator in a grave voice, "this is a most impressive and important occasion." Then he paused, balanced himself upon his left foot, and kicked his right leg into the air in the way favored by ballet dancers. There was a hum of amazement and horror from the spectators, but the senator appeared not to notice it. He whirled around upon the tips of his toes, kicked right and left in a graceful manner, and startled a bald-headed man in the front row by casting a languishing glance in his direction. Suddenly Clarabel Suds, who happened to be present, uttered a scream and sprang to her feet. Pointing an accusing finger at the dancing senator, she cried in a loud voice, "That's the man who stole my bonbons! Seize him! Arrest him! Don't let him escape!" But the ushers rushed her out of the hall, thinking she had gone suddenly insane, and the senator's friends seized him firmly and carried him out the stage entrance to the street, where they put him into an open carriage and instructed the driver to take him home. The effect of the magic bonbon was still powerful enough to control the poor senator, who stood upon the rear seat of the carriage and danced energetically all the way home, to the delight of a small crowd of boys who followed the carriage, and the grief of the sober-minded citizens, who shook their heads sadly and whispered that another good man had gone wrong. It took the senator several months to recover from the shame and humiliation of this escapade, and, curiously enough, he never had the slightest idea what had induced him to act in so extraordinary a manner. Perhaps it was fortunate the last bonbon had now been eaten, for they might easily have caused considerably more trouble than they did. Of course, Clarabel went again to the wise chemist and signed a check for another box of magic bonbons, but she must have taken better care of these, for she is now a famous vaudeville actress. This story should teach us the folly of condemning others for actions that we do not understand, for we never know what may happen to ourselves. It may also serve as a hint to be careful about leaving parcels in public places, and, incidentally, to let other people's packages severely alone. End of the Magic Bonbons. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa. Section 8 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Capture of Father Time. Jim was the son of a cowboy and lived on the broad plains of Arizona. His father had trained him to lasso a bronco or a young bull with perfect accuracy, and had Jim possessed the strength to back up his skill, he would have been as good a cowboy as any in all Arizona. When he was 12 years old, he made his first visit to the East, where Uncle Charles, his father's brother, lived. Of course, Jim took his lasso with him, for he was proud of his skill in casting it, and wanted to show his cousins what a cowboy could do. At first, the city boys and girls were much interested in watching Jim lasso posts and fence pickets, but they soon tired of it, and even Jim decided it was not the right sort of sport for cities. But one day the butcher asked Jim to ride one of his horses into the country, to a pasture that had been engaged, and Jim eagerly consented. He had been longing for a horseback ride, and to make it seem like old times he took his lasso with him. He rode through the streets demurely enough, but on reaching the open country roads his spirits broke forth into wild jubilation, and, urging the butcher's horse to full gallop, he dashed away in true cowboy fashion. Then he wanted still more liberty, and letting down the bars that led into a big field, he began riding over the meadow, and throwing his lasso at imaginary cattle,
while he yelled and whooped to his heart's content. Suddenly, on making a long cast with his lasso, the loop was caught upon something and rested about 3 feet from the ground, while the rope drew taut and nearly pulled Jim from his horse. This was unexpected. More than that, it was wonderful, for the field seemed bare of even a stump. Jim's eyes grew big with amazement, but he knew he had caught something when a voice cried out,
"Here, let go! Let go, I say! Can't you see what you've done?"
No, Jim couldn't see, nor did he intend to let go, until he had found out what was holding the loop of his lasso. So he resorted to an old trick his father had taught him, and, putting the butcher's horse to a run, began riding in a circle around the spot where his lasso had caught. As he thus drew nearer and nearer his quarry, he saw the rope coil up, yet it looked to be coiled over nothing but air. One end of the lasso was made fast to a ring in the saddle, and when the rope was almost wound up and the horse began to pull away and snort with fear, Jim dismounted. Holding the reins of the bridle in one hand, he followed the rope, and an instant later saw an old man caught fast in the coils of the lasso. His head was bald and uncovered, but long white whiskers grew down to his waist. About his body was thrown a loose robe of fine white linen. In one hand he bore a great scythe, and beneath the other arm he carried an hourglass. While Jim gazed wonderingly upon him, this venerable old man spoke in an angry voice. "Now then, get that rope off as fast as you can. You've brought everything on earth to a standstill by your foolishness." "Well, what are you staring at? Don't you know who I am?"
"No," said Jim, stupidly.
"Well, I'm Time, Father Time. Now, make haste and set me free, if you want the world to run properly."
"How did I happen to catch you?" asked Jim, without making a move to release his captive.
"I don't know. I've never been caught before," growled Father Time, "but I suppose it was because you were foolishly throwing your lasso at nothing."
"I didn't see you," said Jim.
"Of course you didn't. I'm invisible to the eyes of human beings unless they get within 3 feet of me, and I take care to keep more than that distance away from them. That's why I was crossing this field, where I supposed no one would be. And I should have been perfectly safe had it not been for your beastly lasso. Now then," he added, crossly, "are you going to get that rope off?"
"Why should I?" asked Jim.
"Because everything in the world stopped moving the moment you caught me. I don't suppose you want to make an end of all business and pleasure, and war and love, and misery and ambition and everything else, do you? Not a watch has ticked since you tied me up here like a mummy."
Jim laughed. It really was funny to see the old man wound round and round with coils of rope from his knees up to his chin.
"It'll do you good to rest," said the boy. "From all I've heard, you lead a rather busy life."
"Indeed I do," replied Father Time with a sigh. "I'm due in Kamchatka this very minute. And to think one small boy is upsetting all my regular habits."
"Too bad," said Jim with a grin. "But since the world has stopped anyhow, it won't matter if it takes a little longer recess. As soon as I let you go, time will fly again. Where are your wings?"
"I haven't any," answered the old man. "That is a story cooked up by someone who never saw me. As a matter of fact, I move rather slowly."
"I see. You take your time," remarked the boy. "What do you use that scythe for?"
"To mow down the people," said the Ancient One. "Every time I swing my scythe, someone dies."
"Then I ought to win a life-saving medal by keeping you tied up," said Jim. "Some folks will live this much longer."
"But they won't know it," said Father Time with a sad smile, "so it will do them no good. You may as well untie me at once."
"No," said Jim, with a determined air. "I may never capture you again, so I'll hold you for a while and see how the world wags without you." Then he swung the old man, bound as he was, upon the back of the butcher's horse, and, getting into the saddle himself, started back toward town, one hand holding his prisoner and the other guiding the reins. When he reached the road, his eye fell on a strange tableau. A horse and buggy stood in the middle of the road, the horse in the act of trotting, with his head held high and two legs in the air, but perfectly motionless. In the buggy a man and woman were seated, but had they been turned into stone, they could not have been more still and stiff.
"There's no time for them,"
sighed the old man. "Won't you let me go now?"
"Not yet," replied the boy. He rode on until he reached the city, where all the people stood in exactly the same positions they were in when Jim lassoed Father Time. Stopping in front of a big dry-goods store, the boy hitched his horse and went in. The clerks were measuring out goods and showing patterns to the rows of customers in front of them, but everyone seemed suddenly to have become a statue. There was something very unpleasant in this scene, and a cold shiver began to run up and down Jim's back, so he hurried out again. On the edge of the sidewalk sat a poor, crippled beggar, holding out his hat, and beside him stood a prosperous-looking gentleman who was about to drop a penny into the beggar's hat. Jim knew this gentleman to be very rich, but rather stingy, so he ventured to run his hand into the man's pocket and take out his purse, in which was a $20 gold piece. This glittering coin he put in the gentleman's fingers instead of the penny, and then restored the purse to the rich man's pocket. "That donation will surprise him when he comes to life," thought the boy. He mounted the horse again and rode up the street. As he passed the shop of his friend, the butcher, he noticed several pieces of meat hanging outside. "I'm afraid that meat'll spoil," he remarked.
"It takes time to spoil meat," answered the old man.
This struck Jim as being queer, but true. "It seems time meddles with everything," said he.
"Yes, you've made a prisoner of the most important personage in the world," groaned the old man, "and you haven't enough sense to let him go again."
Jim did not reply, and soon they came to his uncle's house, where he again dismounted. The street was filled with teams and people, but all were motionless. His two little cousins were just coming out the gate on their way to school, with their books and slates underneath their arms, so Jim had to jump over the fence to avoid knocking them down. In the front room sat his aunt, reading her Bible. She was just turning a page when Time stopped. In the dining room was his uncle, finishing his luncheon. His mouth was open and his fork poised just before it, while his eyes were fixed upon the newspaper folded beside him. Jim helped himself to his uncle's pie, and while he ate it he walked out to his prisoner.
"There's one thing I don't understand," said he.
"Why's that?" asked Father Time.
"Why is it that I'm able to move around while everyone else is froze up?"
"That's because I'm your prisoner," answered the other. "You can do anything you wish with Time now. But unless you are careful, you'll do something you will be sorry for."
Jim threw the crust of his pie at a bird that was suspended in the air, where it had been flying when Time stopped.
"Anyway," he laughed, "I'm living longer than anyone else. No one will ever be able to catch up with me again."
"Each life has its allotted span," said the old man. "When you have lived your proper time, my scythe will mow you down."
"I forgot your scythe," said Jim thoughtfully.
Then a spirit of mischief came into the boy's head, for he happened to think that the present opportunity to have fun would never occur again. He tied Father Time to his uncle's hitching post that he might not escape, and then crossed the road to the corner grocery. The grocer had scolded Jim that very morning for stepping into a basket of turnips by accident, so the boy went to the back end of the grocery and turned on the faucet of the molasses barrel.
"That'll make a nice mess when Time starts the molasses running all over the floor," said Jim with a laugh.
A little further down the street was a barber shop, and sitting in the barber's chair, Jim saw the man that all the boys declared was the meanest man in town. He certainly did not like the boys, and the boys knew it. The barber was in the act of shampooing this person when Time was captured. Jim ran to the drugstore, and getting a bottle of mucilage, he returned and poured it over the ruffled hair of the unpopular citizen.
"That'll probably surprise him when he wakes up," thought Jim.
Nearby was the schoolhouse. Jim entered it and found that only a few of the pupils were assembled, but the teacher sat at his desk, stern and frowning as usual. Taking a piece of chalk, Jim marked upon the blackboard in big letters the following words: "Every scholar is requested to yell the minute he enters the room. He will also please throw his books at the teacher's head. Signed, Professor Sharp."
"That ought to raise a nice rumpus," murmured the mischief-maker, as he walked away.
On the corner stood Policeman Mulligan, talking with old Miss Scrapple, the worst gossip in town, who always delighted in saying something disagreeable about her neighbors. Jim thought this opportunity was too good to lose. So he took off the policeman's cap and brass-buttoned coat and put them on Miss Scrapple, while the lady's feathered and ribboned hat he placed jauntily on the policeman's head. The effect was so comical that the boy laughed aloud, and as a good many people were standing near the corner, Jim decided that Miss Scrapple and Officer Mulligan would create a sensation when Time started upon his travels. Then the young cowboy remembered his prisoner, and, walking back to the hitching post, he came within 3 feet of it and saw Father Time still standing patiently within the coils of the lasso.
He looked angry and annoyed, however, and growled out, "Well, when do you intend to release me?" "I've been thinking about that ugly scythe of yours," said Jim. "What about it?" asked Father Time. "Perhaps if I let you go, you'll swing it at me the first thing, to be revenged," replied the boy. Father Time gave him a severe look, but said, "I've known boys for thousands of years, and of course I know they're mischievous and reckless. But I like boys because they grow up to be men and people my world. Now, if a man had caught me by accident, as you did, I could have scared him into letting me go instantly, but boys are harder to scare. I don't know as I blame you. I was a boy myself long ago when the world was new. But surely you've had enough fun with me by this time, and now I hope you'll show the respect that is due to old age. Let me go, and in return I will promise to forget all about my capture. The incident won't do much harm, anyway, for no one will ever know that time has halted the last 3 hours or so." "All right," said Jim cheerfully. "Since you've promised not to mow me down, I'll let you go." But he had a notion some people in the town would suspect time had stopped when they returned to life. He carefully unwound the rope from the old man, who, when he was free, at once shouldered his scythe, rearranged his white robe, and nodded farewell. The next moment he had disappeared, and with a rustle and rumble and roar of activity, the world came to life again and jogged along as it always had before. Jim wound up his lasso, mounted the butcher's horse, and rode slowly down the street. Loud screams came from the corner, where a great crowd of people quickly assembled. From his seat on the horse Jim saw Miss Scrapple, attired in the policeman's uniform, angrily shaking her fists in Mulligan's face, while the officer was furiously stamping upon the lady's hat, which he had torn from his own head amidst the jeers of the crowd. As he rode past the schoolhouse, he heard a tremendous chorus of yells, and knew Professor Sharp was having a hard time to quell the riot caused by the sign on the blackboard. Through the window of the barber shop he saw the mean man frantically belaboring the barber with a hairbrush, while his hair stood up stiff as bayonets in all directions. And the grocer ran out of his door and yelled fire, while his shoes left a track of molasses wherever he stopped. Jim's heart was filled with joy. He was fairly reveling in the excitement he had caused when someone caught his leg and pulled him from the horse. "What are you doing here, you rascal?" cried the butcher angrily. "Didn't you promise to put that beast into Primpton's pasture? And now I find you riding the poor nag around like a gentleman of leisure." "That's a fact," said Jim, with surprise. "I clean forgot about the horse." This story should teach us the supreme importance of time and the folly of trying to stop it. For should you succeed, as Jim did, in bringing time to a standstill, the world would soon become a dreary place, and life decidedly unpleasant. End of The Capture of Father Time. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.